This Steve Jones Show podcast is now loading. The Steve Jones Show podcast is presented by Sunbury Motor Company, Purdy Insurance, Brewers Outlet, and NIL Game Changers. Bringing you an in-depth look at Penn State sports and more. This is the Steve Jones Show on News Radio 1070 WKOK. The Steve Jones Show is presented by Sunbury Motor Company, Purdy Insurance, and Brewers Outlet. Now, from the Sunbury Motor Studio, here's Steve Jones.
To be with you today, brought to you by our good friends at Brewers Outlet, Reagan Street in Sunbury, the beverage supermarket, imports, domestics, microbrews, the best selection of beer anywhere, wine coolers, water, soft drinks, snacks, they roast their peanuts fresh and out every day, pickle bar, led by the barrels and the dills, my two personal favorites, indeed second to none. All at Brewers Outlet, Reagan Street in Sunbury, the beverage supermarket. Happiest guy in the station today is Todd, because there's no quarterback club today.
I was getting the dulcet tones ready. It was 8 seconds left.
Wow, aren't you a... God, you've been around the suit so often, you're panicking your brains out.
It's inward. You wouldn't have known outward.
Been around him so long, you don't know what to do. All right. So, it's interesting. I was on a show today. I've done interviews now. Monday, yesterday, and then today. And I kind of set today as the cutoff. And I'm not going to do any more the rest of the week. Only because, you know, Penn State's off this week, and, like, at some point I want to do something for me and my family. So I kind of set today as the last day to do interviews for the week. And I was asked a really interesting question that had not been asked, and it was about who's done the better job. Tom Allen or Andy Koltynicki. And naturally, the bottom line was that, you know, that they did a little poll, and I completely understand it, to talk about Andy Koltynicki, even though the numbers for Penn State's defense have been outstanding.
Okay.
So I was asked the question what my opinion was on it, and I gave an answer on both sides, which I think surprised them until, like, I said what I said, and they went, oh, wait, that makes sense. Think about Tom Allen and what he has had to deal with to this point. He constructed a defense during the offseason, implemented in the spring, implemented in the preseason, and now, as of right now, I can't use it as often as he wants. And that is using Jalen Reed in the Lion spot because he had K.J. Winston back at safety. That's one of those, like, people forget that, which I totally understand. Totally understand. And when Winston, he had Winston for five quarters this season. Now, you look at the West Virginia game. Penn State played sterling defense in the West Virginia game, and Jalen Reed was just a wrecking ball. And then, after one quarter of the Bowling Green game, Tom has to change up. Like, okay, there's no K.J. Winston. So now it's going to be, hey, you know, we got to get DeJuan Lane into the mix. You know, how do we position Zaki Wheatley? How do we position Jalen Reed? Okay, now I got to go with the extra defensive backs. What do I do with Elliot Washington? What do I do with Cam Miller to go with A.J. Harrison to Jalen Kimber and so forth, right? Zion Tracy. So he's had to do all of this on the fly after planning from January up until the second week of September of this is how he wanted to play defense. And that is, I think, forgotten in what he has done to this point as the coordinator. They've had to make some tactical adjustments because the way they intended to play, the way they practiced to play, now has had to be adjusted. So you've seen Cam Miller come in and Zion Tracy come in and be part of that nickel package, which you're going to have a nickel package anyway, but it changed a little bit about how Reed played and also the fact that they've had to go, at times they've gone with three linebackers. And remember, two of those weeks they didn't have Dominic DeLuca. It was Tamir Robinson. And that is, to his credit, and he's not getting enough credit for it, they've had to make not just a personnel adjustment, but a tactical adjustment as to how they have played. And they've made it work. Andy is obvious. I mean, when you see the various formations, I mean, I feel like Penn State's a fun team to watch. I mean, they're fun. And you got a quarterback that makes it work. You've got a backup quarterback that you can do a multitude of things with. You've got a tight end that you can do a multitude of things with. You have an offensive lineman who's 345 pounds who can run, so you can flank him out and bring him in. That's right. Right. He's not an eligible receiver, as I pointed out yesterday. I want to make sure everybody knew that. When they split out, I think they actually did that once with Drew Shelton. But when Venga splits out, he's not eligible. He could be standing out there all by himself. He's not an eligible receiver. It's got to be any number that's 50 to 79. You are not eligible regardless of where you line up. And that's college football. The pros are different. You can report ineligible, and you see linemen make catches sometimes. A lineman can make a catch in college football, but they have to change their number before the play. Literally have physically a different jersey on. And as I went through all this yesterday. But Andy's done a great job of looking at his personnel and doing two things. One, what, in terms of their capabilities, what aren't they really proficient at? All right, so let's work around that. And what are they really good at? And let's work with that. He's done a great job of fitting that. He has not done square peg, round hole. This is how we play. Nope. He looked at his personnel and said, okay, you can do this, 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 this. You're not so great at that, so we'll just not do as much of that. And gone from there. And keep in mind, in the running game, what's happened in the running game is actually quite simple. And that is UCLA and USC in particular stack the box. Essentially what they both said, and I understand why they did it. Let's make Drew Aller beat us. And he did. So teams have stacked the box. Now Drew's played so well, now you're going to have to maybe pull a couple guys out of the box, which then will bring back the running game. So that's where they are. That's how I view what the coordinators have done. Andy's done a great job of looking at his personnel and saying, I can exploit that, I can exploit that, I can exploit that, I can exploit that. Okay? I've got the personnel to allow us to do this, 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 and this, and he's doing it. Tom had to make an adjustment on the fly. because he had planned on playing a certain way. Not every single play, but a portion of the time. I mean, a heavy portion of the time. And then he lost a key player, which then forced him to adapt on the fly, and to his credit, he's done it. I know you were going to say something there.
I was going to say, do you think there was more pressure on Tom as well, just because of the expectations of a Penn State defense? That's, you know, that's the one thing that's probably been consistent for the past 4 or 5 years.
There's probably equal.
Yeah.
And the reason being is that for the reason you talked about Tom stepping in for Manny, who stepped in for Brent, who stepped in for Bob Shoup. So, yeah, there's that part of it. But Andy also had the pressure, too. You're expected to come in. And like this is the offensive coordinator whisperer. Here we go. Come on. Show me something. And guess what? They've done very well with it so far. You know, so they both had, I think, pressure on them. You know, to be honest with you, if you talk to the two guys, they don't really. It's like pressure. Okay, we're good. They're not really big pressure guys. But there's always your own personal pressure you put on yourself. And, we talked a little bit about the 12-man penalty the other day. Evidently, he did do it deliberately. Look, here's the bottom line. I think in the final 2 minutes of the game, because now it's defined, you have the two-minute warning. I know it's a two-minute timeout, please. I mean, come on. Everybody knows the two-minute warning. That's what I said to Jack. Jack looked at me and says, what are we calling it? I said, I'm going to call it the two-minute warning. He goes, good. Because that's what we're all used to, okay? With the two-minute warning, any 12-man on the field penalty should be the yardage and the clock reset to where it was when the play started. That's how you alleviate it. All right? If somebody's trying to circumvent and making you run a play to eat up clock while deliberately taking a penalty, fine. The penalty is illegal substitution, 5 yards, and because it's under 2 minutes, the clock goes back to where it was and will start on the whistle of the official. How's that for a solution?
I think they do, I think it works. I didn't see what it was, but they did make an adjustment that you can't do that anymore.
Well, I'm saying, but that should be the adjustment. Yeah. In other words, 5 yard penalty, and like say for example, there's 32 seconds left, and they run the play. It goes down to 23 seconds left. Right, up 12 men in the field. Oh yeah, here we go. You know, and that you know, because there are certain penalties where the clock gets going again right away. Well. Here it is, 5 yard penalty, and guess what? We're going back to 32 seconds. Simple. It's not that difficult. I mean, that's how I'd solve it.
Wait, he was proud of himself, though.
Oh, I know he was. He was. Kind of like when Brett Bielema did that kickoff thing against Penn State. Is it the rule for one season? For one season, the rule was the clock would start when the ball's kicked, not when it's received. So for one season, they did that. So Wisconsin scored late in the first half, and he kicked, well, I don't know, 2-3 of them out of bounds each time time ran off the clock till the ball landed. Right? The clock ran out. You're like, what the heck? Right? Well, needless to say, when the season was over, that rule was gone. Done.
I was not aware of the high school rule that the clock kept running for illegal procedure. Not that they did it on purpose, but Selins Grove ran out like the last 1/20 of a half of a game I was at earlier this season with four straight false starts.
No.
Oops.
Sorry.
That's right. That's not one of the ways that I had in my head that they could run the clock out.
Right. Well, see, again, here's the part about what Lanning did that still baffles me. He's proud of himself because of what it did to the clock. But what if Ohio State fumbled? What if Will Howard threw an interception? Are you still proud of yourself?
Maybe he could see the future and he knew Will Howard was going to try and scramble with 6 seconds left and no timeouts.
Right. Yeah, exactly. But I'm just saying, what if those two things happened? Not exactly out of the realm of possibility.
No, not
I mean,
at all.
I didn't pick out two wild scenarios here. Like, oh, we never thought of that one. I never thought you could turn the ball over. Right. What if they did? Well, guess what? Ohio State still has the ball, maybe last time, but they still have it. It's like, what are you doing? Like, not some foolproof idea he came up with.
I was going to say, not the first coach to ever outsmart himself.
Oh. Yeah. But enough of the Aaron Boone story.
Yeah.
All right. See, Judge homered last night. They acted like it was the biggest home run since Joe Carter in the World Series. It's like, hey, he did it. Like, golly. Hank Aaron played in 17 playoff games in his life. 17. He hit 6 home runs, drove in 16 at .362. But guess what? Now, that's a postseason player. Not what we're watching here. Hope is not a strategy. It's great that he and Ohtani have been massive disappointments. Continue to be. Right? But I'm not surprised. The pressure's greater. And guess what? Some people are better under pressure. Right? And you know, like when a guy's relieved that he hits a home run that takes him from 4-2 to 6-2. He didn't put the team in front. It went from 4-2 to 6-2. Okay. They're like, oh, what? This is the time of the year when you need your stars to be stars. And since 2020, he hasn't been doing it. I mean, I'm talking like this is years now, not like this year. Like, you know, because look, you can go to the playoffs 6-7 times in your lifetime. And maybe the 6 or 7 times, maybe 2 or 3 of them, like, yeah. But you got 4 that are pretty good. Really good? All right. He hasn't had any. We'll see if it gets him off the snide here, and maybe he hits a couple more, and then suddenly everybody has a different opinion. And if it happens, I'll be the first one to say, hey, look, good for him.
I just don't want to have to spend a Tuesday talking to Matt about the New York Yankees, world champions.
Oh, the Dodgers will win the series. Don't worry about that. No. The Dodgers will be there. It's, you know, although the Dodgers have to deal with the Mets first. See, that's the difference between what the Yankees are doing and what the Dodgers are doing. The Dodgers have a legitimate, like, NLCS toe-to-toe opponent. Cleveland had a really, really good year, but right now they don't match up well with the Yankees. The Yankees, the only team in the American League that I think could have given them a fight if they'd been completely healthy was Baltimore. And I think Baltimore would have beaten them, too, if they were completely healthy. See, Baltimore's problem was injuries. Baltimore was the only team in the American League that could beat the Yankees. And Kansas City beat them. Well, when Kansas City won, now the Yankees' path to get there was like a free road, like a, you know, to get there. The Dodgers haven't had that. The Padres, really good, better than anybody the Yankees have played so far. The Mets, really good, better than anybody the Yankees have played so far. So it's been a little different ball game. Take a break. Scott Lauber will talk baseball with somebody who actually knows about it. Well, we all know that when we go to the meetings, the suit knows all. And Todd and I just sit there and humor him. Here on News Radio 1070 WKAM.
October is Truck Month at Asombury Motors with over 100 new trucks to choose from.
Sun, ride with the sun, Asombury Motors.
SMC has 12 of the hard-to-find Ford Maverick trucks priced as low as $27,890, and they get up to 42 miles per gallon. Pick from over 40 of the number one selling truck in the world, the Ford F-150. And Asombury Motors has them slashed up to $12,416. And 4x4 Super Cruise are priced from just $46,874. Asombury Motors in the North 4th Street Auto Plaza. Proudly owned by the Mertz family for over a century. Hurry, sale ends Halloween Eve, October 31st.
Look at Penn State sports and more. This is the Steve Jones Show on News Radio 1070 WKOK. The Steve Jones Show is presented by Brewers Outlet, Sunbury Motor Company, and Purdy Insurance. Now from the Sunbury Motor Studio, here's Steve Jones.
Great to be with you on the show today. Need to talk a little baseball and do that in 1 second here, because we have something important to say before we get to talking some baseball. And the important part that we have to say is quite simple. This half hour being brought to you by Purdy Insurance. Market Street in Sunbury. Go to purdyinsurance.com. Auto, home, life, business, boat, motorcycle, RV, multitude of insurance needs. We all have them. They will do everything to make sure you're fully insured, but also do everything they can to save you money. Customer service is so important. Everybody at Purdy Insurance. Market Street and Sunbury, go to purdyinsurance.com, and let's bring in Scott Lauber now from the Philadelphia Inquirer. Scott, how you been?
I'm doing well. How are you, Steve?
I'm doing fine. I think the last thing Philly fans expected in April, May, and into June was that at this particular week there'd be a postmortem being written about their team. The finish was, for everybody that follows the team, so unsatisfying. In the end, what did you see that kept them from advancing?
Well, I mean, if we're talking specifically about the four games against the Mets, it boils down to two things. They didn't score, and they didn't get the kind of bullpen performance that they were expecting or that they'd gotten all year long. So those are really the two things. But for four innings of game two, they didn't hit against the Mets. It was sort of a different way of quieting them. You know, we were used to seeing when the Phillies went cold during the season, it was because teams would attack them with breaking stuff, often out of the zone. The Mets attacked them with fastballs, and the Phillies didn't hit them, which was a little bit of a head-scratcher. And then, you know, they scored, I think, one run in the series before the fifth inning, and that was the Schwarber leadoff homer in game one. They didn't hold leads late, or they didn't hold... they didn't hold the lead in the case of game one late, but they also just, the Mets were able to pull away late in those games against guys like Jeff Hoffman and Matt Strom, who had been so good for the Phillies all year. So that's really what I think the four games boils down to. But what's so confounding about the season as a whole is that they were 40 and 20, let me get this right. They were 45 and 20 when they came home from London in early June, and they basically were a 500 team from there on out. So it's one of those things where you can look at the four games against the Mets and you could say, boy, what went wrong and how do you fix it, and do you really want to overreact to four games? Or you could look at the final 3 months and say, Why were they so average over the final 3 months? And should there have been warning signs that that there would be an early postseason exit ahead?
Right. So let's play devil's advocate for a moment, Scott, if that's okay with you. We just had the passing at the age of 83 of Louis Tiant. Game 4, 1975 World Series, obviously a bygone era, I will concede. Game 4, he threw 163 pitches and threw a complete game, and the Red Sox needed every ounce out of them they could get. They won the game 5-4, tied the series up at two games apiece. Zach Wheeler threw 111 pitches and had given up one hit through seven innings. In your mind, in modern era baseball, so let's go from a bygone era to the modern era, was there much of a decision to be made there by Rob Thompson?
I don't think so, because, as you said, modern baseball, right? It's a lot different from the baseball that you and I grew up with. I just turned 48. I remember. I don't remember that World Series because I wasn't born yet. It was a year before I was born, but I do remember baseball in the 80s very, very well. And I mean, look, I remember the Jack Morris game in 87. I remember the Oral Hershiser postseason in 88. I mean, I remember when starting pitching was king, and you would ride your horse for as long as that guy could go. And very often they were trained to go well into games, well past 100 pitches, and then some. So that was a different time, a different era. I think Wheeler was fantastic in game one. He threw, remind me again what the pitch count was?
111, I think.
111. I mean, you know, that's about as far nowadays as a starting pitcher usually goes. I think his high for the season was right around that number. So if you ask him to go back out there, I'm not going to tell you that he wasn't going to throw another scoreless inning up there, but it would have been a departure from the way you'd managed him and your bullpen all year long. There was no reason why, even with a 1-0 lead, you don't trust Hoffman in the eighth and Estevez in the ninth. It's what they had done all year. I think you could make the argument, right, if he was at 90 pitches, could he have given you another inning? But at 111, no, I think that that was probably as much as he was going to, you know, as much as you could ask, given the way you've managed him and the way he's been managed his whole career. He is an ace, and I'm not sure that there's a guy that I would rather have on the mound in a game I had to win than Zach Wheeler right now in 2024. Mm-hmm. But, you know, 111 pitches is probably close to his limit.
Fair. I mean, and that's why, see, that's why subjects, I always get bothered a bit when subjects get upset with a question like that. I don't mean you in this case, because it just gives you a chance to answer it. It's okay.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, it's a question. You're allowed to ask a question because what I asked you was an open-ended question. You gave an answer. I think that's why I always get, when people get like, what are you asking that for? I don't know, because it's a question.
Yeah.
I'm not questioning you.
Game in 2009. I'm going to take you back now, and this is, you know, this is relatively recent history, and yet it's 15 years ago. There was a Sunday night game at Citizens Bank Park where Charlie Manuel left Pedro Martinez in for like 125 pitches or something like that, and we were sitting there going, "Is he crazy? He's going to break this guy." I mean, This is unusual, and that was 15 years ago. You know, I think that if Zach Wheeler pitched 30 years ago, is he staying in that game? Of course he is, because he's probably been trained his whole career to go 8 or 9 innings in 130 pitches and then some. But that's not the case these days, and when you've got a bullpen that's built for, you know, normally you're going, you know, in the playoffs, normally you're going to your bullpen in the fifth inning when your starter's at 70 pitches. So I think that was a decision too, that to leave Wheeler in as long as he did. It was Zach Wheeler, and he was pitching great, and so Rob Thompson rode him for about as long as he could, and then, you know, did what he would normally do, which was go to the bullpen.
See, and that's something like, and Scott, you and I are, you know, we've been in this profession a long time. There's a major difference between asking questions and questioning somebody.
Right.
And that's all it is you're just asking the question, right? And then it's up to you, whatever answer you get, you get. It's not a debate. It's like, I'd like to just know what the thought process was.
Sure. Right?
There's a big difference between what'd you do that for? Now that's questioning somebody.
Sure. And look, when I cover a game, when colleagues of mine, when we cover games, it's those are the sort of questions we're asking post game, and it's not like a gotcha question or like we're asking to second guess the manager. We're asking to kind of get his thought process. Take me through why you did what you did, and not like, you know, and you know. In fairness, we ask those questions whether they work or not some of the time.
Right.
Sometimes I'm as curious to know why he made a move that worked as I am about why he made a move that didn't. And I think, you know, obviously, like you said, some people handle that better than others. I think Rob Thompson usually handles it pretty well. But it's kind of the nature of the business.
Step number one, by the way, speaking of Rob Thompson in the off season, was to extend him. What was your thought on that?
Not surprised. You know, I've covered Dave Dombrowski a long time, going back to his time with the Red Sox, and observed him longer than that. And he doesn't often fire managers. He really doesn't.
That's right.
You know, the last time he fired a manager, he fired Joe Girardi in the middle of the season in 2022. But going back, I mean, the Red Sox lost in the first round 2 years in a row, 16 and 17, after winning the division, and he fired John Farrell and went to Alex Cora, who of course managed them to a World Series in 2018. Mm-hmm. So I kind of had that maybe in the back of my mind. You know, they go from winning the World Series or losing in the World Series in 2022 to losing one round earlier last year and then one round earlier this year. So it does go through your head like, boy, you think he might do that, but honestly, what I took out of a 45 minutes of hearing him talk yesterday was, you know, they like their roster. They think that they have a roster that's capable of winning the World Series. They might be right. But, you know, while I think there will be changes to some of that personnel this offseason, it's going to be pretty much the same group coming back. And the onus is on the players, I think. And I think they feel like they've got a manager who players respond to, who has been very successful since he took over in June of 2022, and I don't think Dombrowski felt like what happened in October was the fault of Rob Thompson. So he opted for continuity there. Maybe I was a little bit more surprised that the coaching staff will return in full, although I'm not sure what change I would have made there either. But, you know, they're bringing back the manager, they're bringing back the coaching staff, and it's on those guys to then, you know, try to affect some change from the players that they have and the players to buy into the changes that they're trying to get them to make, which is, you know, from an offensive standpoint, they want them to use the whole field more. They want certain players to make certain changes specific to them. I think, you know, there's going to be a lot of sort of figuring out of, like, how can Trey Turner be a better player? How can Nick Castellanos be a better player? Bryson Stott, and so on and so forth. So, you know, they opted for some continuity in the coaching staff and the manager's office, and they're going to hope that pays off with getting, you know, percentage points better from each player as the season as they enter next season.
As you go through 162 games, guys are going to land on the IL. Turner was on there for a period of time. Bohm was on there. You know, everybody seems to take a turn on there, which then brings up the depth of the farm system. In your opinion, what is the depth of the Phillies farm system where they can maybe fill a gap for 2 weeks?
Well, it's a good question because, you know, you look at the guys that they called on to fill in. When Turner was out, it was Edmundo Sosa. He's a major league player, a major league bench player. When JT Realmuto went down, it was Garrett Stubbs, and they called up Rafael Marchand, who played very well. They don't have a lot of, like, You know, I guess there were times where they called on Cody Clemens, they called on Weston Wilson. Those guys came up from AAA. They have a lot of, like, veteran AAA players. Mm-hmm. But if we're talking about prospects, if we're talking about difference makers, potential difference makers who could come in and be regulars, they don't have a ton of guys who are there, who are, like, on the cusp. Yesterday at the news conference, Dave Dombrowski mentioned Justin Crawford being close or closer. Probably not ready at the start of next season, but he could come quickly next year at some point. They are counting on Andrew Painter at some point next year. Again, probably not right at the beginning of the year, but at some point in the year, they expect he'll be in their rotation. That's really it in terms of, like, difference makers who are on the cusp or getting close. Aiden Miller is a guy they like very, very much. Didn't want to trade him at the deadline. Very good-looking infielder, but not there yet. He's still he barely scratched the surface in Double-A this year. I think that's where he'll begin next year. So, I mean, yeah, they have a lot of veteran minor league guys who can come in and fill in for a short period of time, but they're still kind of waiting on some of their top prospects to really be there and be guys who they can count on as regulars, so to speak.
Reading between the lines maybe of what Dave Dombrowski said, it's not going to be all 26 guys coming back. So where are the areas that he is targeting beyond individual improvement where there maybe he needs a physical, in other words, a different person filling a role? Where is he looking?
So, you know, he talked a lot yesterday about the status quo, you know. Some of that, I think, sort of set up an off season in which he knows it's going to be difficult to really change the roster in a meaningful way because, you know, they have $220 million tied up in 11 players coming back. That's before they tackle their 9 arbitration eligible players. Their salary, their payroll for the luxury tax came in at about $260 million this year. That was over the second threshold. They're going to be back in that same area next year, if not a little bit higher. So it's not really like a roster that's all that flexible. So he talked a lot about the status quo, but he also pointed out the fact that the outfield is a lot less settled than the infield. We all know that. Left field and center field were areas where they platooned a lot this year or, you know, didn't have a high-priced player, you know, chewing up a lot of the at-bats. Those, I think, are the two easiest areas for them to change the personnel a little bit. He said something that stuck out to me, which was sometimes you trade good players for good players. And, you know, I think the way I interpret that is, like, if you could take a Brandon Marsh, let's say, who they like for different reasons. They like because he brings some energy. They like what he can do against right-handed pitching. He is a perfectly okay platoon left fielder right now who they think could – you know, they still think maybe at some point he'll hit lefties, but he hasn't hit lefties yet. Right. You know, you take a player like that who's a good player and you trade him for maybe a player with a little bit of a different skill set, maybe somebody who makes more contact, doesn't strike out as much. You know, that's sort of, I think, maybe the kind of a move I could see them making in a spot on the field like left field. Maybe they look to upgrade in center field a little bit. Yoan Rojas is going to spend the offseason in Florida, in Clearwater. He's going to work on a lot of different things in terms of his offense. But, you know, he's still very much a work-in-progress offensive player who maybe never hits. Who knows? So I do think left field and center field would be the two easiest places to change if they could find the right player, the right match. But, you know, I think they'll be open to a lot of things. He also used the word open-minded yesterday 4 or 5 times in 45 minutes. So, you know, I think that they're going to be looking around to see where could they get better. But, again, there are not a lot of areas on the field where they're going to have a player who's easy to move out in order to get another player in.
How about the ability? What's the opinion of the fourth and fifth starter for them, which is usually in a starting rotation the most flexible parts?
Right. Yeah. I mean, they like their top four very much. Wheeler, certainly Wheeler, Nola, Yep. Christopher Sanchez took a big step forward this year.
No doubt.
And, you know, Ranger Suarez had a great first half, struggled in the second half, pitched well, I thought, in game four against the Mets, or, you know, well enough. I mean, kept them in the game. Did not pitch great, but kept them in the game.
Right.
You know, I think that they're comfortable with those four. Now, they know that they're going to have to do some things with the number five spot, which is a little tricky because, you know, you've got Taijuan Walker, who they now are going to have back in spring training to try to win back the fifth starter job. They're not giving it to him by any means because he had an awful, awful year.
Right.
But there's a lot of money there. I think what they'll try to do, honestly, is they'll try to find a couple of Spencer Turnbull types like they found last year with Turnbull to kind of bring in maybe multiples. Like last year it was difficult. They had a hard time finding starting pitching depth. Maybe they work a little harder on that, bring in a couple of guys like that to compete with Walker, and eventually Andrew Painter, they're hoping, steps into the rotation and takes that spot. So it's kind of a fluid situation. I don't expect them to be hot and heavy in the starter market the way a lot of other teams will be. I think that their concern is more how do they round out this offense and how do they fix or how do they reset the bullpen with Estevez and Hoffman both as free agents.
I love talking baseball with you. So I know I eat up a lot of your time, but I appreciate it really a lot. Scott, thanks so much. Thanks for the time as always.
You bet. Anytime, Steve.
Scott Lauber, he's terrific. He's just terrific. Love talking baseball with him. Half hour brought to you by our good friends at Purdy Insurance, Market Street in Sunbury. Go to purdyinsurance.com. As we continue on News Radio 1070 WKOK.
Party time, game time, or just fun time. Doesn't matter what time it is, because it's Brewers Outlet time. The Beverage Supermarket has the area's largest beer selection. Imports, microbrews, ciders, and domestics. Pick from over 100 ice-cold 12-packs and dozens of 24-ounce singles. Soda, snacks, hot sauces, fresh roasted peanuts. Make it one-stop party shopping, and don't forget the pickle bar. So whatever you're celebrating or just doing it up, Brewers Outlet, Reagan Street, Sunbury, wants to see you. And thank you for your years of patronage.
Hi, this is Season. For over 100 years, the Purdy Insurance Agency has been protecting families and businesses of the greater Susquehanna Valley and beyond. With the experience of our trained and knowledgeable staff, you can rest assured that your needs will be evaluated and met by some of the industry's best representatives. No matter what your insurance needs are, call Purdy Insurance today at 570-286-5855. Visit our website at purdyinsurance.com or check us out on Facebook to see what we can do for you.